From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll meet a computer scientist who works to make technology, especially artificial intelligence, not only more available, but more inclusive and ethical.
We have sort of taken this attitude that computers are impartial, they're not biased, they're just performing simple mathematical operations, and therefore we can use them to solve social issues.
Then the rush that comes with being the host of a live comedy quiz show.
It is very fun to be up there because I think growing up I was a 12-year-old watching David Letterman, and I just thought, man, I don't know what the major is in college to be that, but like that is what I've always wanted to be.
And as Milwaukee prepares to play host to the 2019 North Central Regional Convention of the American Guild of Organists, we visit one of the instruments that will play a key role.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Most of us think of technology as a neutral force. Object or processes are designed and implemented to solve problems, and there are no biases, implied or overt, at work. But our next guest says, not so fast. Technology cannot be neutral. What gets made, who makes it and uses it, and why is dependent upon our societies. And all societies are biased.
Sabelo Mashlambi is a computer scientist and researcher whose work focuses on artificial intelligence and the intersection of ethics, technology, and human rights. He was in Milwaukee last month to speak at UWM, and he joined us then to talk about the kind of issues that he's working on.
So a problem that we're experiencing today with internet technology is that it's being used to break apart the foundations of society. So social cohesion and the harmony that exists within a society. We now have technology that is being used to spread misinformation, to spread hate, and to spread false news, and to essentially control the content that people see, watch, and view. And when a company has the ability to control what people view, essentially they have the ability to influence their worldviews. So now people can be misled, and it's actually a risk to our social structures and our processes of democracy.
So how do you use your expertise as a computer scientist to fight that?
Right. So there's a big consumption with artificial intelligence. And the first misconception is that it's actually intelligent or it's smart. Computers are not thinking at any moment. They're just repeating. They're just following a series of steps and instructions. And so we have sort of taken this attitude that computers are impartial, they're not biased, they're just performing simple mathematical operations, and therefore we can use them to solve social issues. But this is really throwing technology to social issues, and it never works. So now we have technology replicating the social biases that exist, the inequality, the power imbalances that exist within a society.
I was going to say, and amplifying it.
Amplifying it, yeah. So essentially you have powerful, massive systems that are now being used to automate inequality and to optimize it, to even make it even more efficient. And this is something which we haven't been looking into because the public and some of people in our industry, we have assumed that these are simple mathematical models. They cannot be biased, right? How can a mathematical model be even racist, for example? But they're actually replicating the patterns that they observe in society.
And so this is the brave new world that a lot of people, you know, 50 years ago were afraid of, that somehow that this would end up being this essentially neutral tool, what should be a neutral tool, gets used in nefarious ways.
Right. Definitely. It's not a neutral tool because even the process of creating artificial intelligence requires engineers to build models to solve problems that they have identified. And so you're essentially creating tools to solve problems that fit your worldview, what you think needs to change, the worldview you have in mind. And if your worldview is not informed, if it's not inclusive, if other people are not involved in the process of building technology, of the leadership decisions being made on what to build, and even the funding, who gets the funding to build some of these projects. So now you have the embedding of biases within technology. And this happens by prioritizing what features to build, the time spent, the capital spent. These are all value-based decisions. And so it's not neutral. neutral in any way. One, it's not neutral mathematically. It's just replicating patterns that exist. And secondly, when we build technology, we're building technology based on our own experiences and solving the problems that matter to us. So therefore, embedding our own biases and values into these products.
So is there a way to mitigate against that? How do we take this technology that we can't help but build in our own biases and correct for it, or at least become aware of it in the building process, right, so that we can change it?
Right. So definitely for my research, I think that what we have is a value problem, values problem. And the idea there is that our values are already misaligned. And so there are several key areas or key critiques of algorithmic technology. The first one is exclusion, which is the idea that we don't include people in the process of building technology. And so how we can solve that is if we're building tools that will be used on another community, we need to work with the community and determine what will the effect of these tools be on the community. So we need to include community members, digital rights groups, and so forth in each step of the development. And this will also help fix our biases because we can expand our worldview and have a more inclusive and more representative worldview. Another thing we have to take into account is the structural inequality that does exist. So unless the technology we build intentionally challenges these power inequalities, it's most likely going to perpetuate them. It's going to automate them. So are we intentionally designing technology to be corrective, to sort of have equity as part of the design in restoring, in sort of reducing these power inequalities that exist? Another issue is that there are several issues. When we build AI systems, the business models themselves are very problematic. And so they're based on the commodification of personal data. Essentially, this is the commodification of our digital selves, and that's exploitation. And so in order to commodify, and commodification is essentially creating systems that are driven by ads, advertisement. And so in order to advertise to us, companies have to learn about us. They have to know whom we're talking to, whom we're texting, whom we're calling, at what time, what we do online, how long we stay on a website, what we click, what we watch, and where we go. So every part of our lives is being collected and stored online. And these systems are trained on this data to learn more about us in order to sell and recommend more advertisements to us. So we need to sort of challenge this business model, because in order to commodify to us, now we have to be surveilled even more. And so now we have privacy invasions, privacy issues. So it's like a negative feedback loop that's really destructive.
Are we a little too far down the road now? Is there any way back from that kind of privacy invasion and the idea that our every online move is mapped?
So I personally think that we're not too far. I think the public has to get involved. There's some talk that we might have to have regulation. So maybe we could treat some of these public platforms as sort of public utilities and try to regulate them in some way. The key issue with that is that, you know, we have these powerful online platforms, and they're sort of like too big to fail in a way. So now we have private entities that have so much power with little accountability. And so when we see the effects of technology breaking, not just even here in the United States with the 2016 elections and how Twitter and Facebook were used to sort of influence how people voted or what they were thinking, but we see how technology breaks when it's designed here, especially in the Western world, and deployed to other parts of the world. For example, when Facebook is used to spread misinformation and hate in Myanmar, which facilitates genocide. We've seen that happening in Sri Lanka and in Nigeria as well, where hate speech will be spread on the platform, but there's not enough work being done to sort of filter the content. What we did notice, though, is that at the height of ISIS, platforms got together to find a way to filter extremist content. But we haven't seen the same effort, for example, with white supremacist extremist content as well. We can think of the recent shootings which took place in New Zealand. And recently there was an article where Twitter supposedly decided not to pursue this approach of filtering white supremacist content, because in that process they might sort of filter out some Republican senators. So it's really, you know, it's a problem that is not being fully addressed, but it can if the public gets more involved and becomes more aware of the negative consequences that could happen if this technology is not controlled and regulated in some meaningful way.
I know in Europe, Germany in particular, I'm thinking of, they are very, very cognizant of privacy, and they don't use social media in the same way. They hold themselves very much a part of that. And I don't know if that is because of just a cultural thing or if it's actually governmental, you
right.
know. But there are, you know, Western countries that seem to be way more aware of how this is being used than we do. It's still sort of a wild west here.
Yeah. Germany and other countries in Europe are quite stronger when it comes to digital privacy. Recently, Europe passed the GDPR, which is sort of a legal framework for protecting user data. And so now companies have to sort of seek consent in order to collect your data. And there's more of an explicit awareness made to the consumers about, you know, the data being collected and even where the data is stored, how it can be moved, and how it's housed. So we find that the European Union has sort of a stronger view on privacy, whereas in the US, we don't have strong privacy regulations. And that's because a lot of these tech companies are from the US, right? So, you know, there might have been this attitude of, well, you know, let's allow some leeway in order for these companies to grow. And that way, you know, it could benefit the economy or, you know, somehow extend American influence, technical influence and technical priority. So with the privacy concerns, another third player is China. And so China has been seen sort of as this closed off state where there are privacy invasions that are happening at such a large scale. And due to the population, now the idea seems to be that if we don't support U.S. companies, then Chinese companies will take over. And so it's sort of like, now let's support these companies despite, you know, despite the flaws that they may have, it's better than having, for example, the Chinese take over. So, you know, we're not at a place where we have strong privacy regulations here in the United States, and even worse in the global south, in developing countries, where it's hard to have any meaningful type of data privacy laws. So right now, Europe is sort of the shining light on how digital privacy could look like.
You talk about the global south and developing countries. And one of the things I was reading about that you were working on is peer-to-peer networks that actually don't rely on the internet at all.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping you'll talk about that a little bit because that fascinated me, the idea of being able to leverage the technology without having to tap into what is now the global internet.
Right. So this technology allows people to create sort of a private network. So it's a mini internet, if you can say, which relies purely on Bluetooth and Wi-Fi technology. And so this allows people to sort of form networks that are completely offline and mesh networks. So a mesh network is sort of a network where if I want to send a message to someone else, someone probably at the other end of a city, for example, I can bounce my message from one device to another. And this is how the internet sort of works, right? So if we're here and we want to send a message on Facebook, from your computer, the message goes to maybe another computer, maybe a few miles down the road, or then it goes to another server, maybe somewhere in Wisconsin, and then eventually goes to a server in New York, right? So it's going from computer to computer to computer. And so the software that I created is completely open source, so it's free and it's available. And it also follows the same model where now you can send messages from one device to another until it reaches the recipient. And essentially treating a phone as a computer. And there are other ways to do so. You can use sound, ultrasonic sound. And so now I can encode data into sound waves that the human ear cannot sense and hear. So there are various ways to work offline, which is also useful when the internet is being shut down, which is something that we've seen in the global south, especially during the times of elections, where oppressive governments may try to limit communication and how information spreads. And so this is a way for communities to still be able to talk to each other in a way that cannot be disrupted, because it's not centralized as the internet. It's actually distributed. And so there's no one switch you can turn off to then block the communication that happens.
And it sounds also like if you and I had one of these offline connections, we would have to have made that connection somehow, you know, both of us downloading the software, both of
yes.
us creating it, you know, so that I know I want to talk to you outside of the internet. So somebody who's not already in the system can't just jump in.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, that's correct. So you have to at least one person has to have an internet at any moment. So what I've noticed in, for example, in the African continent, you do find apps that allow you to share data or files or applications just by using Bluetooth or Wi-Fi direct. So once someone has the app on their phone, now they're able to share it to another person using offline technology that that already exists. And so you can then now spread it in such a way so it virally spreads and grows, reaching even people that are remote.
And so the idea behind this, of course, is to allow people to communicate when oppressive governments might not allow it. I have to say there's also the downside of that where you might get an ISIS-like group who is trying to foment exactly the kind of hate speech and all of the kinds of things we were talking about on the internet. What prevents this kind of peer-to-peer technology from becoming another internet?
Yeah, that's a very powerful point. Nothing prevents it from becoming like that. For example, WhatsApp is sort of a tool that's used to communicate securely through encryption. So there's no way for a company to know the contents of your message, but they can know whom you're sending it to, but not the contents. And so we've seen how in Brazil, in the recent elections, WhatsApp has been used to sort of spread misinformation and to, spread hateful speech and try to influence the electoral process. And in India, this has also taken place. And so a tool that can be used for good can also be used for bad at the same time. What WhatsApp tried to do to resolve this was to limit how many people you can send a message to at any moment. So before it used to be, I can't remember the number exactly, but now it's been reduced drastically to only 5 people at a time. So it's not what curbs how fast messages spread, but it's not a complete solution. But I think this really speaks to the idea that we can solve social issues by throwing technology at the problem. So ultimately, we have to look at the underlying social issues and try to address those, because technology can be used to perpetuate the social issues. And the only way to prevent technology to perpetuate the social issues is to begin to meaningfully address the social issues. However, people in my community tend to believe that it's better to have this technology available and open, in the sense that what it can do for democracy is much more important than how it could be misused to spread misinformation.
It's better to have more openness than less.
Yes, that's essentially the idea driving the technology that's being created around encryption and offline networks.
As we're sitting here talking, I'm thinking it still comes down to the human being.
Yeah.
It still comes down to us.
Yeah.
And how we choose to use it and how we choose to approach the
right
world. I mean, technology can only do so much.
It can only do so much. And technology will only replicate who we are. So our social interactions that happen will still occur online anyways. So there's nothing magical about technology where somehow it brings neutrality or brings equality and equity. We have to intentionally, as we design technology, think of equity and think of how do we reduce some of the harms that can be facilitated through technology. It's really a human issue, but at the same time, it's not to suggest that we stop producing technology altogether and simply focus on the human element. But it's just we have to be aware and we have to realize that technology won't really solve all our problems. It could help in some ways, but if we're not taking into account that technology, especially artificial intelligence, it's meant to replicate these issues that exist in society and put them into digital society, if I can call it that.
Exactly. It's just like holding up the mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really mirrored to who we are. And when we speak of mathematical models, right, we're trying to match models to patterns that exist in society. And so you know that the model works when it's able to replicate the patterns in society. Now, if those patterns are coming from biases and inequality and the model is able to replicate them, we essentially have now, you know, automated inequality.
I was going to say, we've just amplified the problem.
Yeah. You know, it's something that's going to take a lot of participation from the industry. We have to be aware that we're causing this problem. And some practitioners might feel, sort of attacked, because most people, when they make technology, they're not trying to sort of cause harm, right? everyone has good intentions when creating some of these tools. It's to make the world a better place and to, you know, solve a problem. But we have to critically think of what are we solving and how are we solving it and whom is it affecting and who will be using that technology. So even fixing the apparent biases, it may not even go far enough. Because once we fix those technologies, how will they be used now, right? On whom will they be used?
Right, the unintended consequences.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there are many, and we need to include sociologists into this practice, philosophers, ethicists, and we need to include the entire human community. It's not fair that a group of people get to decide the technology that's going to be used for the rest of the world, for the rest of humanity, right? So, and it's a small percentage of people creating technology. So we need to allow people from the humanities to be actively involved and to be meaningfully involved the way we're being informed on what we're building and what the potential consequences will be like. So we have to really take a deeper look and begin to have more meaningful inclusion and allow different communities to be represented and different disciplines to be represented as we build technology that will be used by the rest of humanity.
Everyone needs to come to the table.
Exactly. Everyone. Exactly. Everyone deserves to be at the table as well.
Sabelo Mashlambi is a computer scientist and researcher whose work focuses on the ethical implications of technology in the developing world. He's currently a technology and human rights fellow at Harvard, and he was in Milwaukee last month to speak at UW-Milwaukee. There is more information about Mashlambi and his work at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break and then meet the host of a live comedy quiz show that takes a cue from public radio's fake news show of record. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. For more than 20 years, one of the funny staples of weekend public radio listening has been the comedy quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. The show features a regular panel, special guests, and callers who weigh in on current news, events, and pop culture in a way that blends improv with information.
The people behind a local comedy quiz show take a page or two from the Wait, Wait playbook. I Should Know This is a monthly comedy quiz produced by Ampersand Theater Company, formerly Mojo Dojo Comedy. Chris Puttycombe is the host and producer, and he joins me in the studio to share the story of the show. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me. It's very kind of you to ask.
So you do a number of things, but let me ask you this. How did a high school teacher end up hosting a comedy quiz show?
Well, a number of years ago, I started performing in town through sort of the usual channels that people get involved in staged comedy in town, and met some people. And I had always had this idea of a show where the original idea was I wanted it to feel like hanging out with fun people in your kitchen late at night, you know, like where we're all having a good time. There's a lot of callbacks and puns and everybody feels part of the action. I also felt like when I went to comedy shows, I wanted some music because I think music brings a really fun energy. And when I go to music shows, I want some comedy. And so it's sort of like that peanut butter cup commercial where you got your chocolate and your
right.
peanut butter. And so I was like, what if we put those together somehow and created something? And the whole show is kind of a Frankenstein affair where it's hard to pin it into one box. But that was the genesis of it. And then I have met some really good people along the way, and we were kind of spitballing these ideas. And at the time, Mojo Dojo Comedy was starting up, and I was one of the people that helped start that. And we all kind of forged this idea together.
Well, and it's improv, but it's improv that involves people who aren't necessarily trained improv people.
Yeah, there are a lot of trained improv people. And I will say that, like, it's deceptive in the sense that it's not improv in the sense that it's not narrative. Like, there's not – we don't get a suggestion and then create a scene, although those are great shows and you should go see those. But the soul of improv in terms of the yes and concept, in terms of affirming what people bring to the table within the show context is there. It's just sort of subtly woven into the fabric of what we do.
Well, and I think the people involved in it have to be quick the same way an improv person has to be quick.
Yeah, I think that – and I think you, to your earlier point, we have – not always have people on the show. We have guests on the guest panelists on the show that are not necessarily trained improvisers. And so to make that work, and I think to bring out the best in them, we do a really good job of affirming what they bring. And the energy, we're very, very intentional about it being a very positive, constructive energy, because it can turn and you can get real bitey. And when people feel on their hind feet a little bit and intimidated, they tend to go negative. And so we try to keep it pretty open and pretty upbeat. And that all comes from improv. And so that people that aren't trained, I think, tend to have a good time and tend to feel like their best selves.
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I have been a guest on this show,
correct,
a guest panelist on this show before, and I am going to be a guest panelist again as we're having this conversation, which is a thrill for me. But who are some of the other people that you've brought in as guests on the program?
We have had a number of really, I think, notable guests. John Gerda was on the show. We've had musicians like Paul Sebar. Willie Porter's been on the show. Peter Mulvey, Jeffrey Foucault, sports talk people. We've had Mayor Tom Barrett was on, which was
I've heard of him.
A huge coup. Yeah, we hustled very hard to get that to happen, and we had a great time.
Now, how comfortable was he in a situation like that? Because he's sort of a great, what they would call after dinner speaker in the forensics world. But
he was great. I will say. In fact, I don't think we've had a bad guest so far, knock on wood. He was wonderful. He's very tall, and I think he's good at talking to people, and he's charming, and I think he was quite good.
Talk about the space. It is a unique space that you're in, and I gather not one that you imagine you'll be in forever. But how has it contributed to what you've been able to do?
Sure, it's a great space. We do the shows at Urban Harvest Brewing Company, which is at 1024 South Fifth Street in Walker's Point. It was a theater at one time, and then the brewery moved in. And so they had this theater space that they weren't really using. And so it was a good marriage for Mojo Dojo. And so it's a 60-seat theater. There's four rows, and it's theater-style seating and then a very wide and shallow stage. And so it works out for us because we can put the band in a corner and we can put the panel on the other side, and there's a screen in the middle for the clues and things. But it's a pretty warm room, I will say. There's not really a bad seat. When we started, there was a booth in the back that we called the Sinatra booth that doesn't sadly exist anymore. But it is a very intimate space, and I think it lends to a feeling like by the end of the show, people feel like they're in on the inside joke, which is great.
Well, the other thing is that the audience might feel like they're in on the joke, and they also kind of play a role in making the evening what it is.
Sure. When you come in, you fill out a card, and amongst other things, it asks if you have a question for the panel, so that you can ask a fun question, or you can ask any question you want, really, but we'll pick the fun ones. And there's a box that says, I would be willing to be part of the show. So your question may get asked and discussed, which is fun, but then in the second round, we have three lucky and willing participants who join.
Lucky is a subjective term in this case.
I think it's very lucky, if you ask me, but not everybody may feel the same. They come on stage and they are partnered with one of the panelists, and they go home with some fancy swag, and it's all fun is had by all.
I'll have you know, by the way, that that my wife is a big fan of the myriad of shirts that I won the day that I was on. She uses them to paint.
Oh, great. Yes, there is a door prize for the winning panelist, and they mostly come out of my basement. Not, the prize is not the panelists.
So as kind of the quiz master here, is there a comedic rush you get from being the guy that runs the show?
It is the funnest thing to do, and it's hard to explain it because the format of the show is a mod podge of things. But even within that, the quiz is very difficult to explain because the questions are not questions that are empirically answerable at all. They are all just there as a skeleton for fun people to come up with smart aleck comments about. It's very similar to like some of the British like QI and some of the British panel quiz shows where they have really clever people on and they have conversations about what the quizzes are. It's in that vein in a lot of ways.
Maybe What's My Line meets a fever dream.
Yeah, kind of. Like, sure, right. It is very fun to be up there because I think growing up I was, you know, of a 12-year-old watching David Letterman on NBC, and then he switched to CBS, and I just thought, man, I don't know what the major is in college to be that, but like, That is what I've always wanted to be, is to, you know, even if you watch like late at night on the 0.2 or 0.3 stations, they'll have like old Carson Tonight shows, and they're just interesting, fun people having interesting, fun conversations. And that is the soul of what it is. And that's why it's so hard to explain sometimes about what the show is. But once you go, it's like, oh, that was so fun, and I totally get it now.
Well, and amazing to think of, you know, Carson and Letterman and all those people having these fun kind of conversations like day in and day out for years.
Right, right. And it was just like random people that happened to be there, and they weren't necessarily plugging a movie. They're there because they're on a TV or in a movie, but that wasn't why they were there necessarily, or what was going to happen while they were there. That's I think so fun, and it would be great if people felt that that's what was going on there.
Do you have ambitions for the show down the road?
We do. We've been at Urban Harvest for 3 or 4 years, and we've sold every show out since we've been there. It's 60 seats, which has been a great size for us. But, you know, some of these shows, you know, the mayor's show, we sold out in a day. And some of the shows when we have fairly notable guests will sell out within a day or a week. And even whatever the show is, it's always sold out. So we would we're starting to look around for a place like a 100-seat theater or more. So if any of you have an abandoned theater somewhere somewhere you need to book a show that comes with a 60 to 100 people off the bat, we would love to have a conversation with you. But yeah, we would love to grow the show for sure. We'd also talked about doing some shows this summer in Madison and kind of grow it west a little bit as well.
Well, and so as we're having this conversation, I am your guest for the June show, and
yes,
then I'll be at the Sands for 3 weeks.
Sure,
and
right.
Opening for Sammy Davis.
Correct.
But who do you have? Who should people know about? That's that will be on in subsequent shows.
Well, Mitch will be on the 22nd of June. July 27th, there's a guest in the works, but I shouldn't say yet, but pay attention, it's coming. And then August 31st is going to be Sista Strings, who are so fun and so talented, and just incredibly cool young women in town, so we're excited about that. And then we're going to move to monthly shows. We started a production team that helps to write the shows and book the talent, so it's going to be great in the next several months ahead.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. I am looking forward to my next appearance. And Chris Puddicombe, thank you so much for telling the story of it.
Thanks for asking me to do it, Mitch.
Chris Puddicombe is the host of I Should Know This, a live comedy quiz show produced by Ampersand Theater Company. The next installment features guest panelist, Mitch Tighe, and takes place next Saturday evening at Good Harvest Brewing Company in Walker's Point. There is more information at WUWM.com. And you know what? I should have known that.
What a coincidence. We will take one last break and then head to Tosa to hear a pipe organ. It's one of the instruments around the area that will be played as part of the upcoming North Central Regional Convention of the American Guild of Organists. Stay tuned for more when Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM.
We are back with Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. And that is the pipe organ at St. Jude the Apostle Church in Wauwatosa. It's one of the instruments being showcased during this year's North Central Regional Convention of the American Guild of Organists.
We recently joined St. Jude's Director of Liturgy and Music, Crawford Wiley, who's playing for us today, and Larry Wheelock, who's coordinating the convention here in Milwaukee, at this church to hear the instrument and to learn more about the convention.
Well, the American Guild of Organists is an organization that's about 125 years old, and it was founded to give support to organists. We are, in many ways, an educational institution, but we also give collegial support to organists and choir directors nationwide. The organization currently has just under 15,000 members in the United States and a few in Europe, and we hold national conventions in even-numbered years, and regional conventions all over the country in odd-numbered years. Local chapters of which there are 14 in our region, bid for the opportunity to do a regional convention, and it's kind of our turn. We have not done a regional convention in about 30 years, so we're very happy to host this, and it's also a special occasion for us. This year is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Milwaukee chapter.
And Crawford, how long have you been playing?
I started when I was 13.
So for you as a working organist, what does the Guild do for you?
For me personally, I haven't had that much interaction with the Guild, but the Guild is enormously responsible in the local area for putting on different events that support particularly students. Educationally, the Guild plays a huge role in that.
When you talk about young students and people who are interested, this is a monstrous instrument to get your hands and feet around.
Oh, sure, yes.
You know, and not just this one, but pipe organs in general. How interested are young people in playing this, Larry?
Well, it's interesting. Young people are not playing the organ in the numbers that they were perhaps 50 years ago, but there is a very avid and skillful group of young people coming up as organists. We have, in fact, made it a point to have in our convention as performers, fully a third of our performers are under 30. So these are people who have gone to university to study organ, and in many ways, we're kind of seeing a renaissance of younger people playing the organ, not in numbers, but the quality of organ playing by the young people is just far and beyond. I'm just astounded. People as undergrads are playing the type of music that I was only ready to play in graduate school. So not only are we still getting wonderful organists who are young, we're getting very high quality organists.
The other thing I think that's interesting about the organ repertoire is that there are a lot of people writing now for it.
That's
true. Opposed to, I mean, there are in other classical music venues, there's modern classical music, but it seems like the organ repertoire is constantly expanding. I'm always hearing about new pieces.
And in fact, we have commissioned a piece by a Wisconsin composer, Jeffrey Harriet, which will be premiered at one of our recitals at the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist, specifically commissioned for this convention, and hopefully will be a good addition to the repertoire.
So Crawford, when you are approaching a new piece versus, say, something that you might be very familiar with,
sure,
Bach, for example, who wrote a lot for the organ, how do you approach a new piece?
The same way you'd approach something? You don't want to approach an older piece of music with a kind of boxed-in mindset. You want to approach it openly, knowing what the composer's frame of reference is and what he or she is thinking of aurally. But yeah, I would say that hopefully you have the same open mindset to both, so that you don't have a path already predicted for the interpretation of the piece.
Okay. What are contemporary composers doing, and Larry, you can jump in on this too, that might be different from, say, the piece we heard, which is what, late 1800s?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, obviously they're limited to the same notes and sounds that we all have, but they're putting them together in different ways. I see a lot of experimentation in form, and I see a lot of experimentation in color and range. I see composers experimenting with what are the limits to the variety of sounds that the organ can make. And yet there's another school of composers that are doing things in a very traditional way, but with modern harmonies.
When you say modern harmonies, what does that mean?
Well, for example,
more dissonance?
That would be one way to approach it. Although I have to be careful in saying that, because if you study the music of Bach, you will clearly see that there is dissonance there, but he resolves it in particular traditional ways, whereas modern composers are not always beholden to make those kind of resolutions. So you might get some dissonance that goes through the piece, and a piece might even end with a dissonant sound, and that kind of separates it from the traditional music.
I think there's also a process of learning. If you've learned to appreciate different styles of painting, you come to see that the texture of the paint itself can be a source of intense beauty, in a way that in older forms of painting, the French academic school of the 19th century, you might not notice the brushwork itself, whereas in, you know, say a Jackson Pollock painting, that's precisely the point of it, or at least one of the points. So I think if you're listening to more recently composed organ music, or really any kind of music, and you think, oh gosh, it's dissonant, you might want to think, well, what is the point of the music anyway? What is the composer going for, because if you're just noticing dissonance, you're probably not seeing the right thing. You want to open your ears a little bit.
Right. Yeah. You're stuck on that one point, and you're not letting it feed you.
Because there's so much beauty there to wash over you. Yeah.
Well, and the thing about, and we're standing, or I'm standing, and you're sitting in front of this organ that was put in not too long ago.
2009.
So it's only 10 years that it's been here. Describe what we're looking at, if you would.
So you see in front of you three keyboards, which roughly correspond to the piano keyboard, and then a pedal board, which is essentially the same thing. Each keyboard controls a different number of sets of pipes. So a rank of pipes controls all of the notes of one particular sound. So for instance, this. That's the 8-foot principal pipe on the grate, which is the middle keyboard. And yeah, so you pull out the 8-foot principal stop and you have wind rushing into the wind chest for, that particular rank. So for every stop, there's a particular set of pipes. Some of them are flue pipes, like that principal. They work essentially like a recorder. And others of them are reed pipes, which work more like a clarinet. And we actually have a stop called the clarinet. Some of them are trumpet stops. So each keyboard controls a different set of those pipes, and I guess that's the simplest way to explain it. You then combine all of those in various ways according to what palette you want to use.
Is that written into the music, or is that up to the organist?
That's a really interesting question.
Yes.
Some pieces of music are prescribed very closely by the composer as to which stops to use, and that's really perplexing because no two instruments are alike. So even if the composer specifies to the nth degree what stops you should use, the chances that your instrument, even if it has that particular stop, will actually have that stop voiced in the same manner as the composer intended is really unlikely. So you always have to use taste and judgment. This is why educating yourself about what different instruments sound like is so important, so that you think, well, what if the composer notated this in the score? What is it likely that the composer had in his or her mind? And how can I achieve that sound on this particular instrument? Or maybe you think, I'll never achieve that particular sound. There's nothing like it. So what is aurally pleasing? You know, what communicates the music, in other words?
So what happens is that, like in jazz, organists really have to be interpretive. Even if you're playing directly from a score, you have to be able to envision and hear the entire piece.
Oh,
and it allows you, the improvisation comes in deciding where it's going to be played.
The art of improvising has never died out.
Yeah. Organists improvise equally as much as jazz players. But they start with, even when they're working with fixed literature, every organ you approach is going to render that literature in a slightly different way. And the art of the organ is to find a way that each instrument can render the music in the most faithful or the most musical way.
So you mentioned that you have a footboard
down
there that is essentially a piano keyboard.
Yes. That's just what
it is. And so one of the tricks of this, you have to be very dexterous. And whatever the foot equivalent of dexterous is, you have to play with your feet and your hands at the same time.
Yes, and they do separate things.
And you have to have a good sense of balance to not fall off the bench. It's happened.
And so could we hear a little bit
of
the foot?
That's a bit.
And so then you do that, but then something else is happening up here.
Yes. So you do them together.
So could you give us just a little bit of that?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
God, that's beautiful. It just sounds so wonderful in this space and on
yeah,
this instrument.
The space is really lovely. It has a lot of room to bloom, so to speak.
It's bright enough without being too bright.
Yeah, you don't lose the focus of the sound. Yeah.
Right, it's just lovely.
We always say that the most important stop on the organ is the room.
Yeah, this is a good room for it.
Well, Larry, tell me what people can expect and what kind of public events are happening with the conference. I'm assuming it's mostly for guild members.
It's primarily for guild members. We have 165 coming in from 16 different states, most of them here in the North Central region, but we have them coming from as far away as California, Ohio, and Florida for this convention. People normally attend in their own region, but people also are free to look around and see what region has the artists I'm interested in. So we've drawn some people from other states as well. We will be going hard from 3:00 Sunday afternoon until Wednesday evening. And I have to say that regional conventions are a lot like marathons, because we will be boarding a bus and going for a recital and then a class, and then get on the bus and go for another recital, and then perhaps some other type of program, a reading session where we read new music. All of this happens, and we bus people from church to church. We have about 12 different venues that we'll be using, almost all of them having wonderful organs. And we will also be having a choral group, which will be performing at the Basilica without organ. So it's a wide variety of music. And we have 8 different artists who range from someone who specializes in French Romantic instrument, Lynn Davis, to Jelani Eddington, who will be presenting a theater organ recital down at the Carmex Labs, where they have a wonderful new theater organ. So it's a wide variety of music. There are 8 or 10 events which are open to the public at no charge. So we're happy to have the general public come to those 8 or 10 recitals. Obviously, the classes and such are not for the public, but our convention attenders will be kept quite busy.
It sounds it. And if there are 12 or 14 different organs, it's going back to what you were saying, the same piece of music is going to be different in every one of those places.
Exactly.
And it's a perfect way to illustrate that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, Crawford, what are you looking forward most to hearing?
Probably the recital that's going to be here. I don't get to hear many other people play the instrument, so it'll be lovely to actually sit down and listen to someone else play her.
And it'll be exciting because the artist who's going to be playing here is Greg Zelick, who's the municipal organist in Madison, a recent graduate of the Juilliard School, and just a terrific, terrific player.
So that's
one of our young artists.
One of the young artists. That's going to be amazing. Well, I hope to catch up with you at some point and find out what you thought of how he handled the instrument.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank both of you so much, and best of luck with the conference. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Larry Wheelock is a local organist and the coordinator of the 2019 North Central Regional Convention of the American Guild of Organists. Crawford Wiley is the director of liturgy and music at St. Jude the Apostle Parish in Wauwatosa.
Thanks to WUWM's audio engineer Jason Reavy for recording us and the organ, and to the news department's Angelina Mosier-Salazar for taking the photos and the video that you can find on our website, WUWM.com. There is a link there to the convention's public performances as well, and that wraps up the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4:00.